one person, I am Inuk. Inuk, I am Inuk. I'm Madeline Alekerelek for Words and Culture. Atsunai!
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin. Soko seni denit e. Ninen yuji hina.
Ekose.
Kakuhutau. We'll see you again.
Katie, you want some cool new music to listen to? Want to know about up-and-coming artists, albums, and more? Well, come hang out with me every Tuesday from 12 to 1. Raccoon City's where I'll be. Hope to see you there.
Is bird note.
No fat, molt free.
During fall migration, this bird banding station, operated by the Willistown Conservation Trust, is in full swing. It's late September at the Rushton Woods Preserve on the outskirts of Philadelphia. Led by licensed bird banders, a team of volunteers catches birds using mist nets, 8-foot-tall nets made of fine nylon string that practically disappear when strung out between poles. There are 15 set up around the nature preserve today in wooded areas and along trails.
Where are you, little one? Oh,
this volunteer is gently untangling a gray catbird from the mist net.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Each bird is put in a cloth bag and carried to the banding station, a small covered wooden platform. There, a bird bander affixes a small metal band around its leg. The team measures different aspects of the bird.
Age, sex if we can, the fat accumulation, the bird's weight, 40.9 grams for that bird.
When this catbird is spotted in the wild, or caught again at a banding station, it gives researchers insight into the movements and lifespan of this individual. Compiling records for many banded catbirds helps keep track of the whole species. Newer technologies like GPS trackers make it easier to precisely track birds around the world. But for a bird lover, banding offers a unique thrill. Holding a wild bird, like this veery, in your hand, then feeling the beats of its wings while it flutters away, all while contributing to community science.
There he goes.
Did you hear it? It went veer.
For Bird Note, I'm Allison Wilson.
Time. I don't see the point of running this race. At the end of the day, we're all gonna face the same damn thing. So we're all gonna die. I've been told if I'm on my way, I'd go to heaven after my last day. So far as that we all end up in the same graveyard, and it makes no difference, because we're all gonna die. Aces and eights, they're the dead man's hand. It's in the cards, don't you understand? Thank you.
on October 7th, 2024, CJSF was able to attend a BCNDP panel event that was taking place at the SFU Burnaby campus. At this event, Rhea Arora, who at the time was the MLA candidate for the Burnaby East Riding, was in attendance at this event, and afterwards, CJSF was able to sit down with her in studio for a brief interview in which we discussed key policies that the NDP had put forward during the election cycle. Some of these include housing and affordability, as well as some of Rhea's political experience, specifically within local labor movements. At the end of the interview, she shares some advice for students and younger people who may feel disillusioned by the political process. Since the recording of this interview on October 7th, 2024, Rhea Arora won her election for her riding and now serves as the MLA for Burnaby East. Please take a listen. Once again, this is Danny, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, being broadcasted live from the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish Nations. I am here with BCNDP MLA candidate Rhea Arora. Thank you for taking the time to have this conversation with me.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate being here with you today.
Yeah, and the first question I want to ask you is, how are you doing today?
You know, I'm doing great. I had a really interesting all-candidates meeting with the Burnaby Board of Trade this afternoon, and then I got to meet with many activists here at SFU with folks with the SFU NDP, and we got to talk about the issues that matter to students and folks that live up on this mountain and just generally big issues, and I really appreciated the discussion.
Yeah, for sure. It was, I think, really great to have all those students there to kind of just see some of the faces behind one of the major political parties this election cycle as well. So, yeah, that was really great to see. So the next question I want to ask you is, seeing as how SFU and Burnaby Mountain are such a large portion of the Burnaby East riding, how do you believe that the NDP would need to tackle the issues facing the area in a way that's more specific to the younger student demographic of Burnaby East?
I mean, that's such a good question, but I think the sort of bigger aspect to this is like general affordability, right? Being able to stay, if not on the mountain, in the area, being able to afford the tuition, and also being able to plan for the future. Some of the things that the BCNDP is doing is allowing for a BC Access grant of $4,000, which would be paid upfront. That relieves the financial burden on students. We're also doubling trades apprenticeships for folks who want to study in the trades and be able to become a Red Seal certified. Those are very good, unionized, stable benefits, you know, paying jobs. And that also means that they're able to stay in the city, work closely. So that might be working up on the mountain, might be studying up on the mountain, might be living. And there are folks here that are doing a variety of different degrees. And so there might be folks that are more focused on building small business. And so, especially when folks are in the second or third year, I know that many students start to kind of develop a plan of like what they want to do, or sometimes even the projects that they take on in school allow them to creatively think about, you know, what do they want to open in terms of a business? Is it a brick and mortar? Is it online? And so there's small business supports that the BCNDP is providing as well. And I think that, you know, we think of youth as if it's sort of separate, but in so many ways they're not. They're dealing with the same affordability issues as many other folks. The piece that's, I think, more consistent is that a lot of them are students. And so the more that we can relieve the financial burden on students, like, you know, getting rid of interest on student loans, these are tangible ways to put money back into students' pockets.
Now, for those who may not know, you are the director of organizing campaigns for the BC Federation of Labor, correct?
Yeah, I am, yeah. This is, I would be going on my fourth year.
And with that experience, how does your planned approach to addressing the needs of local workers differ from other MLAs in your riding?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think the number one thing is that I actually come from the labor movement. And this is not some kind of, you know, club where you can't get in. No, in fact, my mom came from India at the age of 14. And at the time, there was easier access to becoming a care aide, which also happened to be a unionized job. And so I grew up in a union household because of my mother. In fact, she fought against the nurses that were working there, the care aides that were working there, because there was actually racism in that workplace. And so what was happening is that there were tickets for each floor in terms of the patients, and there were harder floors and easier floors. And what the care aides that were doing that were white is that they were providing easy tickets to their friends. And so they were calling them up and saying, come and get your tickets quickly. What happened is that there were predominantly South Asian nurses working with them. And so they were getting the tough floors again and again and again. What did that lead to? Higher risk of injury. In fact, injuries that were so severe that my mom's ligament was torn out of her arm. And wow. She's been on long-term disability now for quite a long time. But she worked there, I think, for over 15, 20 years. However, at the time that this was happening, my mom became involved in her bargaining committee. She started to talk to the employer about what the issue was, and she fought for fair rotation language in her collective agreement. And there are many care aides that have been hired after her. And the beautiful thing about it is that it was a great example for me to understand the collective power we have when we take on any issue in our workplace, especially if it supports everybody. And it's such a social justice lens that I've had access to, but then at the same time working in the labor movement and at the provincial level means that I've had access to the private and public sector, the building trades, to you know, federal level workers, provincial level workers in the healthcare sector, film and television. Basically every major union in the province sits on our table officers, which is part of the structure of the BC Federation of Labor. This means that I am very aware of a lot of the issues that are taking place for workers in the province. And I think that means that I bring a unique perspective when we're thinking about the needs of workers in the caucus meetings in government. I'm going to be able to speak better to these issues because I have this knowledge.
Right, and you have that sort of personal connection to the issues as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's what drives me.
Now, my very last question for you is, you know, what advice would you have for younger people? So, you know, people 18 to 30 who may be students who feel disillusioned when it comes to the political process and elections, specifically regarding issues such as affordability and housing that the province is facing. You know, for a lot of people, you know, even within my age group, it feels...
What's your age group?
18 to 25.
Okay.
And, yeah. You know, for a lot of people within that age range, it can feel pretty bleak. I guess, what advice would you give to people that, you know, may think, what's the point?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say that sometimes we feel overwhelmed by the issues that are in front of us. And so we tend to step away from the issue completely and sort of lose hope completely. And one piece of advice that my mom has always given me that really sticks with me is that you cannot change anything from the outside and you can't change anything from the sidelines. So if there is an issue that you deeply care about, that you want to see changed, it is important for you to actually get involved on that specific issue. One, to educate yourself. Two, to raise public awareness. And three, to garner support to either influence government or get elected and make those changes yourself.
And I think that is all the time we have for this interview, but I want to thank you so much for the panel that you held earlier and this interview as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Once again, that was Rhea Arora, the newly elected MLA for the Burnaby East riding.
You're listening to Met Radio 1280 AM CJTM in Toronto. This is Mia Johnson with the Local Journalism Initiative. A new report from the Toronto Climate Observatory finds that Bay Street's funding for climate emissions has reached an all-time high. Banks, asset managers, and pension funds in the Toronto downtown core are responsible for investing over $1.43 trillion in fossil fuel companies in 2022. This makes the sector the fifth largest climate polluter in the world, and Canadian environmental organizations Stand.Earth and Environmental Defense are calling for political action. Today, I'm joined by the Climate Finance Program Manager, Alex Walker, at Environmental Defense. They work towards aligning Canada's financial sector with climate action. Hi, Alex. Thanks for being here.
Hi, it's great to be here with you.
The new report that came out this month, the Environmental Defense were advising on this report. Could you tell us, what does this number mean? Could you put this into perspective?
So this recent report by this team at University of Toronto found that financial institutions, 18 financial institutions headquartered around Toronto's Bay Street, were responsible for 1.44 billion tons of carbon dioxide, which is about 1.4 gigatons. The entire emissions in 2022 throughout the entire world were 36.8 gigatons of carbon dioxide. So 1.4 is not, you know, not too far away from 36.8 when you think about it in global terms. So if Bay Street were a country, it would be the fifth largest emitter of fossil fuels in the world, bigger than, more emissions than the country of Brazil. And that's about 100 times the emissions of the city of Toronto. So really, really significant emissions paid for, essentially funded by institutions, financial institutions on Toronto's Bay Street.
Mm-hmm. And you said that it's beating out these countries like Brazil, Indonesia, Japan. How does this happen?
So a financed emission, this report is looking at financed emissions. And what that is the emissions generated by projects that a company has loaned money to or invested in. So say a bank, for example, writes a loan to a coal company, and that money enables the coal company to extract more coal, which is burnt to produce energy. So the kind of extraction here is facilitated by the money provided by the financial institution. It's been financed by that company. So when what this report did is it looked at all the money, $1.4 trillion, which was sent from these institutions to fossil fuel companies in 2022. And then it did some kind of equations to figure out, you know, how many emissions does that money pay for? So it can be, it's hard to think about it when we're comparing it to countries, but it's basically Bay Street is paying for an awful lot of emissions in the world.
Mm-hmm. And in the report, you said that, like, what this, the number that is coming up may not even be completely accurate because often these emissions go unreported. Why is that?
Yeah, the team of researchers at the University of Toronto found some significant differences between when they examined what these emissions were and what these companies reported themselves. So in Canada, financial institutions have to make a series of reports to their investors and shareholders about the kinds of things they're financing. And as part of this, what they can do is they can report on their emissions. This can include the direct emissions they have or the emissions of companies they finance. It's kind of a bit of a confusing maze of emissions. So fossil fuel companies themselves, they report on their emissions, so their direct emissions from, say, if they're extracting gas from the ground and some of this gas leaks, they're responsible for those emissions. But also when people burn fossil fuels to produce energy and a fossil fuel company has produced that fossil fuel, that's also part of their emissions. So there's a lot of different layers here, but there are two kind of main issues to underreporting. Number one, the financial institutions get data from their customers, and sometimes this data is incomplete. Second issue is that there are no requirements for financial institutions to report fully on their emissions, which means they can miss things out, they can kind of underestimate that. There's a lot of leeway in how they report because there's no rules in place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The city's climate mitigation plan, the Transform TO Net Zero Strategy, it's the Toronto City Council's plan. They approved this in 2017, and the gist of it is to reduce community-wide greenhouse gas emissions in Toronto to net zero by 2040. With the report that's recently come out this month, how realistic is this goal?
What I can say is that Canada has the kind of technology and the money and things to invest in the energy transition. It just hasn't kind of got the incentives in place yet to do so. So the emissions from these financial institutions, that's not included in the City of Toronto's report. They kind of, that the city kind of considers their buildings and waste and transport. So this wouldn't be included in what the city is reporting.
In what the city is reporting on, like, how can we mitigate these strategies? You've made a number of calls to action to Canadian financial institutions and our government. Could you share what they are?
Absolutely. So Canada's financial institutions are regulated at a couple of different levels. There are some rules that they have to follow set by the federal government, and there are some rules they have to follow set by provincial government. Mm-hmm. The federal government is massively falling behind other countries in the rules it's setting to kind of align our financial sector with climate action. Many places around the world, for example, the EU has a ton of rules in place to make sure the financial system is prepared to deal with climate change, but the federal government in Canada is really lagging behind. So we've seen some very recent movements from the government to kind of require big companies to report more of their emissions and make more disclosures around climate change, but it's absolutely not fast enough. So kind of the rules the government have already said, imagine if there's a sinking ship, you know, the current rules say, yeah, we should count the holes and figure out how many holes are sinking the ship, but there are no rules to ensure that these holes are plugged. So the next step from disclosure is to require financial institutions to have credible climate plans, which will outline how a financial company is actually going to take the steps to reduce its emissions. You know, these plans require goals and timelines in place, and the government needs to be able to ensure that these plans are happening. So that would be the real change the federal government could make to help address this problem.
On a smaller scale, I guess, specifically in just the city, I know over the summer we were seeing sort of widespread flooding in downtown Toronto, Union Station completely shut down. In the report that resulted, this widespread rainfall in $1 billion in insured losses alone, what risks do events like these pose for the city going forward if we continue this way?
The biggest impact of the flooding in Toronto was the personal impact. So many people had their homes flooded, you know, had to pay out insurance damages. It disrupted travel. It was a really scary time to be in the city, at least for me, and I'm sure many others. So the main impact of climate change is the human impact, and all of those people who have to experience those the kind of damage from things like that. But as you mentioned, there are significant insurance damages and infrastructure damages when a major weather event like that happens. Canada has around $3 billion per year in current insurance damages because of the cost of climate change. It's mm-hmm. getting very expensive. So it's very much the financial risk of these weather events. The insurance companies, every time something like this happens, insurance companies have to pay out money, and that gets expensive. It requires them to increase premiums.
Mm-hmm.
Climate change is very expensive.
Those are all the questions I have for you, but is there anything I haven't asked you that you want to say, Alex?
Just maybe to hammer home to listeners how much money we're talking about. The financial institutions were responsible for $1.4 $3 trillion of money to fossil fuel companies in 2022. That's about $4 billion a day. And another interesting fact is if instead of giving that money to fossil fuel companies, they just divvied it up between all of the people who live in Toronto, everyone would get about $510,000. So it's a huge amount of money that our banks, our pension funds, our asset managers, you know, we're customers of these banks, that is being sent to fossil fuel companies. And it's causing things like the recent flooding in Toronto, or the wildfires in Jasper, and the hurricanes down in the States. It's very real impacts. So I think the City of Toronto could do a lot to advocate for change for institutions kind of headquartered here.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you for bringing this report to light, and I really appreciate this conversation.
Of course. Thanks for talking about it. It's a really important report, and I'm glad it's getting some airtime.
Met Radio reached out to the Canadian Bank Association for comment. They got back to us with a statement via email. They said that Canadian banks recognize how crucial they are in helping move towards a lower carbon future. Banks in Canada are working on carrying out climate action plans and reporting on those actions. They're working with clients across industries to help them explore energy transition opportunities and to finance new and existing green projects. Projects that aim to meet Toronto's net zero ambitions. The music for this episode was produced by Robert Johnston. This is Mia Johnson with the Local Journalism Initiative.
Greetings, netizens. Join us every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific for Bitcoover FM, featuring the best in chiptune, video game soundtracks, synthesized music, history of electronic instruments, and more, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We'll see you in the virtual plaza, and remember to synthesize with nostalgia.
Explores 1990s indie classics, recently exhumed underground gems, every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time and 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. Tune in if you're a slacker, loser, or creep for an hour of positively nostalgic triggers and some new stuff too. On CJSF 90.1 FM or streaming at cjsf.ca.